Good morning. Time now for an early morning roundup of the day's news from the war fronts of the world. This morning, we're going to hear from our on-the-scene reporters in just a moment. We'll hear from London and Washington. But now, from the San Francisco newsroom, the news of the Far East. First, from the Dutch East Indies capital city, Japanese air raids on the Borneo oil port of Balikpapan and on the island of Sabang were reported today by the Netherlands East Indies High Command. Sabang is an island off the northern tip of Sumatra. The High Command also announced that 9 persons were killed and 41 injured in yesterday's attack on an airdrome in middle Sumatra Island. The communique said 9 enemy bombers escorted by 6 fighters carried out the attack on the vicinity of Balikpapan, damaging the lightship near the city. 3 planes raided Sabang without inflicting damage, the communique added. The battle for Singapore and command of the southwestern Pacific swung into new stages of bitterness and ferocity today. The Japanese are throwing troops at the Paunal Line sector held by the Australians in Johor State, some 110 miles north of Singapore, and are attempting their now familiar flanking landings on the western Johor coast. Domai, the Japanese news agency, has broadcast from Tokyo a report the Japanese have captured Pontian Besar, 25 miles from Singapore. We repeat this claim comes from Tokyo. But the zealously fighting Australians and British say they have smashed landing parties on the West Malayan coast and are keeping up a continuous resistance to the land attacks. It is jungle warfare by separate groups instead of massed battles like those of Russia and Africa, and the Japanese are finding the Australians tough customers indeed. In what virtually amounted to an order of the day, Major General Gordon Bennett, leader of the jungle-trained and high-spirited Australians, told his men today that, and we quote General Bennett, "We've got to go out after the Japanese and get them, or else they'll get us." He has discarded any thought of a waiting game and called for aggressiveness. General Bennett's artillery pounded the Japanese in the sector where between 800 and 1,000 Japanese were killed in an Australian ambush last week. Along the coast, Australians helped an Indian force mop up the Japanese, who gained a temporary foothold at the mouth of the Muar River, 90 miles northwest of Singapore Island. The combined forces destroyed 8 enemy tanks and sent the remnants of the Japanese force hunting for cover in the rubber trees. Singapore itself took a beating from Japanese planes yesterday. The British acknowledged for the first time that raiders damaged the naval base area, setting fire to fuel oil. The Japanese in Tokyo claim that their bombs damaged the headquarters of the British Far Eastern Command. With the situation growing more grave each hour, the British have called up more men to defend Singapore. All European male Britons under 41 not already serving in the fighting forces have been ordered to register Wednesday for military duty. As the Malayan struggle nears a crisis, a gallant band of Americans and Filipinos are contributing materially to the United Nations defense of Singapore and the Netherlands East Indies by holding in check a large army of Japanese on Luzon Island. But there seems to be no doubt that its situation is deteriorating. In 2 weeks, relentless Japanese pressure has forced the men of General Douglas MacArthur back 20 miles on the Bataan Peninsula, even though at tremendous cost to the invaders. It is reported that General MacArthur has won back some previously lost positions, but there are signs that the Japanese are grouping their preponderant strength for a fresh offensive against the MacArthur army to defeat it as soon as possible and press on to richer fields. While the British stiffened their defense of southern Malaya and Singapore, they looked also to the protection of Burma, and announced the arrest of Premier Yu Saw for plotting with the Japanese. An announcement from Prime Minister Churchill's residence in London says that the Premier, who left London last November in anger after failing to obtain dominion status for his country, has been arrested to balk a conspiracy to hand over Burma to the Japanese. The statement said Yu Saw admitted he's been in contact with the Japanese since the war began in the Pacific. He will not be permitted to return to Burma. Where the premier was seized is not known, but it might have been in Cairo, Egypt. He left Lisbon January 3rd by plane for Cairo and has not been reported since. Burma, lying between Japanese-occupied Thailand and India, is being used by the British for air bases for planes attacking the Japanese on the Malay Peninsula. Burma also is the starting point of the famous supply road to China. And here's a note on the war in the Far East from Bombay, India. The government of India today froze all Philippine assets in India because the lawful government is not operating in the Philippines. We take you now to New York.
York, we have a dispatch from Moscow. Russian and German troops are fighting hand-to-hand in the streets of Mozhaisk, and here at this important city west of Moscow, the Russians say they're defeating the cream of the German army. Mozhaisk was the pivot point in the original Nazi offensive against Moscow. And now we'll switch overseas again to one of our reporters on the scene. This time, we take you to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. London today learned from Singapore that the British have made a new withdrawal in Malaya. That seems to be about the only real information available. The authority of London quarters today will only say that the Japanese claims of an advance are true, but exaggerated. Meanwhile, the enemy are making a new threat at the Burmese tin. They're advancing toward Tavoy, headquarters of the Burma tin industry. Prime Minister Churchill was received by the King at Buckingham Palace today. Mr. Churchill will have a chance to test parliamentary opinion on the failure to defend Malaya when the House of Commons meets. But it's thought he may wait a few days before making his expected statement on his conversations with Mr. Roosevelt and on the course of the war. Meanwhile, the trial balloons about sweeping government changes seem to have been pricked, and most political observers here take the line that I told you about a few days ago on this broadcast, that the Prime Minister may make some changes, but they won't be drastic ones. But he will have to explain away a lot of questions about the Far East and about some of the tangles in British production. Most people hope he'll be able to do something about both points. They'd like to see some of the cabinet dead wood cut away, and they'd like to hear that something is being done to halt the Japanese advance somewhere. They hope for these things, but they know that Mr. Churchill's job is a big one, and they'll accept whatever he has to tell them about the future, good or bad. A senior military officer, just back in London from Malta, today said the enemy was stoking up a little bit with air attacks on the island. He said air defenses were very strong, but he wouldn't make any definite statement as to whether they were adequate. He said the lessons learned from Crete were being put into practical operation. At long last, the British have restored Haile Selassie to the throne of Abyssinia. It's announced here that an Anglo-Ethiopian agreement has been signed, restoring full sovereignty to the emperor and granting him every assistance to place his kingdom on a sound economic basis. So the first victim of Axis aggression gets back what Mussolini took from him at a time when the Western democracies still believed in appeasement. That policy failed in China, in Abyssinia, Spain, and finally Czechoslovakia. When Mussolini started his invasion of Abyssinia and used to shout about having 8 million bayonets, the democratic statesmen used to shiver at the thought of war. Now Mussolini has proved the greatest bluff of modern times. The Germans hold Italy, but Selassie is back on the throne. There's no official comment in London today on the arrest of Yu Saw, the premier of Burma. But it's felt generally that it's a good thing he was grabbed before he had the chance to become a Japanese quisling in Burma. The official announcement from 10 Downing Street said he'd admitted being in contact with the Japanese authorities since the outbreak of war with Japan. He visited Britain last October and was shown around some of the British defenses. He's reported to have had a stormy meeting with Mr. Churchill, who refused his demand for a written statement granting home rule to Burma after a fixed period. Yu Saw had been impressed by Japanese successes in China, and he hinted while he was in Britain that British refusal to give him what he wanted might mean he would play the Japanese card. The Russian trade union delegates who have been touring Britain's war factories attended British trade union meetings all over the country this weekend. The biggest meeting was held yesterday in London, where 5,000 British Union representatives cheered Madame Nikolaeva, secretary of the Russian All-Union Council of Trade Unions. She told the British that the friendship forged in battle between the peoples of Britain, Russia, and the United States must go on after the war. She said Russia's slogan is everything for war, and she asserted that Russian women workers will not permit one machine to stand idle. When a husband or a brother goes to the front, she said, his place is immediately taken by his wife or sister. Madame Nikolaeva, a bespectacled woman of 70, told the British delegates tales of German torture, rape, and slaughter that must have given many of the delegates a new light on the war in Russia. The meeting passed a resolution pledging untiring effort to keep up and speed up war production. On Saturday, the biggest sports crowd of the war, 64,000, attended the international football match between England and Scotland, held for Mrs. Churchill's Aid to Russia Fund. Over the weekend, other meetings were held at places like Edinburgh, Southampton, Derby, and Bristol. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now, to round out the picture of the news this morning, we turn next to our own capital and a report by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
Well, good morning, folks. You know, there isn't really any what you might call definite spot news this morning, and I'm going to take a chance and discourse on a situation. Because there's too much jealousy and hair-pulling here in Washington, and I'm going to relate it to you because one of the very highest officials of the government brought it to my attention and had a long talk with me about it, and he personally told me he is considering going to the president to resign a high office, and I can't even indicate or intimate who he is or what his job is because he may not do it. I cannot try to do my bit for defense and live in this mean, sneaking atmosphere, said he to me, where there's so many self-centered people striving and conspiring for more personal power and more limelight and that sort of aggrandizement. That was his complaint, and that was his quotation. Now, it may have been overdrawn, it may have no legitimate place in this sort of a formal newscast, but it seems to me on this, I hope it's a dull Monday morning. If I've missed anything, I'm scooped. But it might serve as an indicator as to why certain things are as they are. You know, the war has not startled all of Washington into the crystallization of that clear American unity that it requires, and of course it will have when they get down to business. That shakeup in the production end of the war effort by the president, who incidentally spends 18 hours a day thinking and working on this production program. But that shakeup is accompanied this morning by several columnists and editorial comment and politicians' side remarks, which shows there's still jealousies, personal grievances, and so forth, for instance, as to whether Big Bill Knutson will do what Nelson wants him to do, or whether Knutson, as a lieutenant general in the army, will snap his fingers and laugh in his slow and chuckling Danish manner and say to Nelson, I'm in the army now. The effect of the Truman Committee report, slamming production and all that therein is, seems to encourage more committees of Congress to seek for more witnesses to find out about more things. There must be half a dozen ambitious heads of committees on Capitol Hill striving to start something of a probe into the Army or the Navy or the war or production. Here, for instance, is a new five-man committee of the Senate that says it's going to investigate rubber when, as a matter of fact, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, Jesse Jones, loan administrator, have explored what seems to be every nook and cranny of the rubber subject around the world. And I was told on Saturday by competent authorities that Jesse Jones and his crew up there at RFC had bought every scrap of rubber that they could buy under the circumstances and had done exactly the right thing by sponsoring the investment of $400 million in the synthetic rubber business, which up to now, of course, has been a relatively small affair, to a large extent experimental. But there seems to be almost an hysteria in Washington to get into the limelight through criticizing somebody or getting a job head and shoulders above the rest of the crowd and say, see what a big boy I am. Of course, that's all going to disappear. But it's here now. One outstanding success, which even the sour-faced Truman Committee endorsed, is the program of the United States Maritime Commission, which has now been announced as an added program of 632 more merchant ships to be built, a fleet by itself. If what they say they're going to do really happens, we'll see an average of 3 ships a day down the shipways of America this year and next, the greatest shipbuilding program in the history of the world and the answer to the cry for ships, 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 and more ships. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news at home and abroad, ladies and gentlemen. Now, you've heard on this program from our newsroom in San Francisco, John McVain from London, and Earl Godwin from Washington. This program is presented at this same time every weekday over many of these stations. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.